Indiana University Bloomington's faculty declared no confidence in President Pamela Whitten, Provost Rural Srivastav, and Vice Provost of Faculty and Academic Affairs Carrie Dougherty at the meeting hosted by the Bloomington Faculty Council Tuesday. Faculty cannot remove a leader from the university, but the vote is a significant marker of internal opinion. The petition to hold the vote said current IU administration is encroaching on academic freedom and shared governance. In a statement on its website, the Board of Trustees said Whitten had its full support. The statement also noted the difficulties of higher education today and that Whitten's IU 2030 plan is the roadmap to the university's growth. This Friday on Noon Edition, we'll talk with experts about the significance of a no-confidence vote in the future of higher education, right after this hour's news.
Support for WFIU News comes from
Bunger & Robertson, attorneys at law, celebrating 75 years with a range of legal services from estate planning to personal injury and immigration. Information at lawbr.com.
Production support for Noon Edition comes from Smithville, fiber internet, security solutions, and voice in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Bloomington Health Foundation, empowering a community and government partners by bringing together nonprofits, businesses, and philanthropists on initiatives to gain access to healthcare resources. Learn more at bloomhf.org. And from Estate and Downsizing Specialists, LLC, offering complete turnkey service for estate and downsizing clients, from initial consultation through home cleanout to final real estate and personal property sales. More at edsindiana.com.
Welcome to Noon Edition on WFIU. I'm your host, Bob Zaltzberg, along with our co-host today, Aubrey Wright, who's a higher education reporter for WFIU and WTIU. We're talking with guests today about the IU faculty no confidence vote in top IU administration. The Bloomington Faculty Council hosted the vote and reported 948 faculty attended the meeting at the IU auditorium on Tuesday. More than 3,200 faculty were eligible to vote. In this vote, 827 faculty voted for the no confidence resolution. That was 93% of the vote, and there were 804 people who supported the no confidence vote. That resolution for President Whitten, I should say. For Provost Srivastav, it was more like 90% of the vote voted for no confidence in him, and also there was a third administrator and an assistant provost.
Vice provost.
47 faculty voted against that, but 672 faculty voted for no confidence there. So that was all of them. I think I got those numbers wrong, but I was close. 93%, 91%, and 75% voted no confidence. It was very high. So we're going to talk about that today with our three guests. We have Megan Zanies is joining us from Washington, D.C. She is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Mm-hmm. Russ Skiba is here in the studio. His PhD is professor emeritus in the School of Psychology program at Indiana University and former director of the Equity Project at IU. He is the co-founder of the University Alliance for Racial Justice. And also Richard Schifrin is here. He's IU Distinguished and Luther Dana Waterman Professor in Psychological and Brain Sciences. If you have questions or comments, you can give us a call at 812-855-081 in Bloomington or toll free at 1-877-285-9348. You can also send your questions to news@indianapublicmedia.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at WFIUWTIU News. So we have a lot to cover today. This is a huge story in Bloomington and in higher education. We have a lot to get to. I want to start with Megan, the senior reporter, Chronicle of Higher Education. Megan Zanies, thanks for being on the program. I wanted you to sort of frame the conversation for us. How common are these votes of no confidence today. Is this an unusual situation?
Thanks for having me, Bob. Yeah, so in 2021 at the Chronicle is the last time we officially lodged votes of no confidence. At that time, there were 24, two dozen, which seems like not a whole lot in the grand scale of higher ed, but that was, at the time, the highest number that we recorded. That number has generally been going up since the 80s. 2023, we actually saw even more of them, some pretty high caliber institutions seeing votes of no confidence. West Virginia University, Rutgers, Temple, University of Arizona. So some state flagships joining IU now in this category.
All right. Russ Skiba, I know why don't you just tell our listeners how you voted and why you thought this was an important vote and why you voted the way you did.
Sure. It's important to say that I was not one of the organizers of the vote of confidence. And I frankly wasn't, I was definitely leaning towards a vote of no confidence, but I wasn't exactly sure how I'd vote on all three. But hearing just the evidence provided by a number of speakers there, it's important to recognize this. I think this is a really critical moment in terms of I've been here, was there 31 years and 5 years since as a professor emeritus. And I've never seen this level of conflict here between the faculty and the students, and the faculty and the administration, rather. And it started soon after President Wynton arrived in the fight against HB 1134. There was instructions from the administration that faculty were not to use their titles in testifying about the bill. And, it's kind of an odd thing to say. It would be like saying to teachers, don't say you're a teacher if you're testifying against an education bill, or a doctor, don't say that you're a doctor in testifying. So that kind of got the faculty a little riled up. The Caitlin Bernard issue, where Dr. Caitlin Bernard was attacked by Attorney General Todd Rokita, there was never any support for her, even though the Indiana Supreme Court censured Rokita for that. We never heard any support from President Wynton for Dr. Bernard. The graduate student strike, again, I'm not sure the faculty really would have come out very strongly about a graduate student union, but when the administration began saying to the faculty, you need to monitor the behavior of your graduate students, let us know if there's any slippage in their work and report back to the administration, that kind of surveillance did not sit well with the faculty. And the faculty got really involved in that strike. All the issues last fall with Abdul Nakar Sino and his suspension over essentially not filing some paperwork, the Halaby exhibition, the issues with the Kinsey, and then most recently, Senate Enrolled Act 202. That's a very serious threat to the university. It requires a change in tenure procedures. And some people say eliminates tenure. It institutes a set of system of surveillance about faculty. They could be reprimanded, demoted, even fired. And really has its target faculty of color. It's a bill that's as the Chronicle has said, as Megan and her colleagues at the Chronicle have reported. It's one of 28 states that have these bills, these anti-DEI, the bills that would dismantle this diversity, equity, and inclusion, and in the process probably drive away a large percentage of our faculty of color here. And so it's been surprising that there hasn't been more support for the faculty of color. So all of those things put together, I think, were the things that really, really drove this. I don't think you can point to any one thing, but I think that history of conflict over free expression and support for the faculty, I think, has come to a head in this.
I'm going to turn to Richard in a minute, but I want to follow up with you about Senate Bill 202. I thought President Wynton actually did make a statement opposing Senate Bill 202.
Unfortunately, she was the only one of the university presidents. But I think there was a perception that it need, nevertheless could have been a lot stronger, and I think there's the racist nature of this bill, and I'm going to come right out and say the racist nature of this bill, because it's one of bills in 28 states, copycat bills attacking DEI and eventually leading to things like Florida firing all of its DEI staff at the University of Florida. I think it's important to see leadership on that, and so I think in that the coming at the same time as real serious attacks from the radical right in the supermajority at the state level, I think it's important to see support for our institutions and especially for our faculty of color and LGBTQ faculty, and we would have liked to have seen more of that.
Okay. Richard, how did you vote on this, and why did you choose to make the stand that you did?
Let me start by saying that I agree with everything Russ Skiba just said. I was I was as appalled by all these incidents and decisions as he was, as most of the faculty were. And in addition, I was not that much in favor of the choice of President Whitten for president. I had nominated Lauren Roble and Fred Tate, in fact. Nonetheless, having seen the choice of the first woman president at IU, I felt that she deserves a chance to learn the current culture at IU and establish her credentials as a president. And I knew, of course, that most of the people showing up at the auditorium would be those who have grievances with the things that were going on, and there'd be a vast supportive vote for no confidence, and that it would be important to have some contrast, let's say, to that vote. So I felt that I had to say something that maybe this was not just a vote against the particular incidents, which were serious ones that Russ mentioned, but was really a statement about these three people as a totality, about their jobs as an administrator. And I felt that this was like a trial without a defense, that this was a set of terrible grievances about all the things that were wrong, but no comments about what they were doing well. And that didn't strike me as fair. So I therefore made a statement that we ought to give a chance to the administrators to recover from these errors, learn from them, do better, and establish the case for their abilities as administrators.
Okay.
Can I just say one thing? That there, sure, there were, in fact, a number of comments, especially about the vice provost, that were questioning. And you'll notice that wasn't as high a vote as the other two. So there was quite an openness to hearing comments, defending them. And there were fewer comments about the provost or the president, but there were also some defenders of them as well.
Okay. Aubrey?
Yeah. I have a question for Megan, kind of zooming out a little bit. You have analyzed data from researcher Sean McInnes that he keeps on no confidence votes, and you know this better than anybody here. So I was wondering, like, did you find anything surprising? Like, what sticks out to you?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, it's important to note that votes of no confidence don't have any inherent power. Nothing automatically happens now as a result of these votes at IU. They don't automatically kick President Whitten or anyone else out of office, but they do indicate a pretty strong signal of, faculty dissatisfaction, obviously media attention, questions in and around campus and in the community. And so I think that that's one thing to note. What surprises me is that, in general, we've seen a widening in scope of what votes of no confidence are taken for. Typically, as Sean McInnes' research shows, there's one of three reasons historically that a faculty might take a vote of no confidence. That might be what they perceive as financial mismanagement by a president, failure to participate in shared governance is another big one, and then just generally interpersonal conflicts. But as I said, in recent years, we've seen that scope widening quite a bit. Faculty have he can vouch for a whole host of reasons. IU, as Russ described, a whole litany of factors mostly related to academic freedom. And so this is, I think, indicative of a larger trend over the last few years of faculty feeling more emboldened to take votes and to take them on a variety of topics as well.
I might mention that we did ask a lot of people to come on. We asked the president. We tried to get the president or the provost or somebody from the Board of Trustees. We were not able to get anybody. But they all made statements after this. And just want to mention a little bit from the IU Board of Trustees statement, because they say they are strongly behind President Witten. Just a little sampling from their statement. The current environment across higher education is unprecedented. These challenges have confronted leaders across U.S. universities at a staggering pace, encompassing an evolution in societal perceptions of higher education, a shifting public policy landscape, and world events resulting in unrest on campuses across the country. Indiana University is no exception. As we move forward together, we must demonstrate shared respect and grace in navigating these tumultuous waters. Meanwhile, the ambitious work of the university must go on. At our direction and with our support, President Pamela Witten is leading at a time in higher education where the status quo is not an option. And it goes out to further support the president. So I just wanted to mention that. The president made a statement. Aubrey, do you want to mention a little bit about what the president's statement said?
Yeah, and she released this after the faculty vote on Tuesday night. And basically she talks about how she would like to move forward with the faculty. And she mentions that while we will not always agree, our community is made stronger by an array of viewpoints and voices, including those expressed as part of this process. She's talking about the vote of no confidence. And then she goes on to mention about how trust in higher education is at a record lows, but expectations are at record highs. And she says there is no going back to an earlier time. And she continues saying she welcomes thoughtful ideas and consideration.
I want to get our panelists' responses to those. But first, I do want to play a clip. We talked to Sean McInnes, who Megan mentioned. Sean McInnes has a master's and a PhD from Ohio State University, the Ohio State University, but he is also now in the private sector, and he has maintained a database about no confidence votes for the last 20 years. And he's started studying this when Harvard took its no confidence vote against the former president, Larry Summers. He's makes several key points. This is one thing we asked, our producer, Benta Boutier, asked about what happens now, what might come from this vote. So we want to play you a little bit about what he said.
It's very common after a no confidence vote for the trustees or for the president to pledge to work together and to try and fix things and to rally around their leadership at a time of great change and a time of great challenge for higher education. This is sort of a boilerplate response that I've seen for the last 15 years or so. In this case, though, I think given the status and the prestige and the history of IU, I think that the academic leadership there has a real opportunity to actually correct this and move on beyond it. I don't foresee this being something where people lose their jobs or resign and so forth in the next several months. It's possible. I mean, as I said earlier, it's a 50-50 chance almost. But I think that if they heed the results of this vote and work hard to identify those concerns, talk with the people who are most affected by them, and show that and demonstrate that they've listened and are able to communicate that they've done their best, I think it'll be okay. But sometimes that doesn't work, particularly, as I said earlier, at some of the smaller institutions, it's sort of, as the cliche goes, the ship has sailed. I think here at a place like IU, there's a chance really for true reform and healing. It's very common after a no confidence vote for the trustees or for the president to pledge to work together and to try and fix things and to rally around.
I think we're back. Yeah. I want to get reaction. Rich?
The statements that I heard you read, I think, are skirting the real issue, and understandably so. What we are seeing is a really unfortunate intrusion of politics into the university operations. Mm-hmm. And this is really terrible what's been happening. It's unfortunate, and I don't want to excuse what we have seen, the decisions that have been made, but I understand that they were prompted by the current political situation, which is just terrible, when we see what should be done correctly at a university being altered and distorted by the intrusion of politics into the situation. Mm-hmm. And I see that as the real fundamental problem.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with Rich Moore. You know, a couple things that stood out to me in the regardless of how we're taking the statements from the Board of Trustees and President Whitten in general, the board said that status quo is not an option, and that unfortunately seems to be the message that we're hearing from the radicals in the Indiana State Legislature. You know, the status quo really is respect for faculty governance, respect for free speech on campuses, respect for diversity, social justice, and equity. Those things are the status quo, and those are the things that are really at risk and being attacked in this legislation. It's really being controlled by, let's be honest, by a national movement. The Indiana Bill 202 is just one of many, many copycat bills that are attacking these things. President Whitten said that there's no going back. But again, radical majority would have us go back, you know, years and generations in terms of protections for civil rights. I do think that Sean was correct about possibly heeding results. And I think, you know, right now the one issue that is current out of all the issues that came before the vote of no confidence is this issue of Senate Enrolled Act 202. The university has to make a report to the legislature September 1st of this year. And, if the administration were to come out strongly demanding that faculty and supporting faculty involvement in anything regarding the implementation of 202, I think that would really help. If the university were to come out and say, there has been a $30 million initiative from President Whitten about diversity, and we are here to defend that, and we'll defend our faculty of color. I think those things would go a long way.
We have a question that has come in. I think Aubrey has it over here that's sort of along these lines.
Yeah. So the question says, how might any of the panelists work within the obvious appropriation of progressive ideas of diversity, as in intellectual diversity? Do you see a way to use that term? And then the question goes on, like, if I have a conversation about abortion and open up the space up to all perspectives and then navigate that powerful space, is that cool, is how the question ends.
I think it's very cool myself. we should have respect for all viewpoints. And I think that, but I think it's also important to point out that those things have been buzzwords and essentially dog whistles from the authors of this bill. The term intellectual diversity actually was coined by a hyper-conservative faculty in the early 2000s. He suggested that phrase to his students to fight back against liberals and the left and the civil rights movement by using their own language against them. So that it's more a dog whistle than anything else. And they're really – in Indiana, the Commission for Higher Education had a report last year that they issued on undergraduates. They surveyed 18,000 undergraduates, all the undergraduates in the state, And 75% of them felt that there was no problem of free speech on their campus, that speakers are represent all viewpoints, and there wasn't a single group that less than a majority said have a right to express that opinion, whether that be different races, men, women, liberals, conservatives. They all felt that they had a right. So, you know, it's certainly we certainly have to continue, and it is cool to have all viewpoints. But I think we have to understand that this bill was never about that. This bill is about dismantling DEI, and it's a very serious attack on the university's institutions, and particularly on faculty of color and LGBTQ faculty.
Megan, I wanted to ask you to weigh in on this. You know, Russ has talked about, you know, the Indiana Senate bill. Are you seeing these kinds of bills around the country? I know you are. Russ mentioned how many states I think they were in. But are these – is this political landscape leading to a lot of these no-confidence votes?
You know, I think it's difficult to say based on the last couple of years. But as Russ notes, we have been tracking this at the Chronicle, the DEI legislation that's been happening across the country. Since 2023, we've seen 84 bills across 28 states, and 12 of those, including in Indiana, SB 202, as Russ mentioned, have been signed into law. And so I do think that there's, you know, certainly a political climate that's prompting a lot of faculty to want their university administrators and to want their presidents to speak out against a lot of these legislations. And the presidents historically in the last few years have not felt like they can, or they don't want to wade into what's, you know, a very politically charged topic, especially at a public institution where they might be receiving funding from the state, as is the case here. And so certainly I think the circumstances around some of these bills definitely create a culture that would engender a vote of no confidence.
All right. We have a clip that we got from Michael T. Miller, who's a professor of higher education at the University of Arkansas. He's the editor of the Journal of Research on College Presidents. And he talks a little bit about the pressure that's on university presidents because of some of the things that Megan just said.
I think we're seeing a real evolution of what higher education institutions are and what they do. And they're becoming increasingly fiscal entities, meaning that the priorities and the things that the individuals who control the institution care about are financial in nature. There's a real interest in efficiency in the bottom line. And that means boards of trustees prioritize the financial well-being of an institution, perhaps more than student learning. And that's kind of a big statement, and that's not always the case. And I think every board in the country would deny that. But board members will look with great interest at audits and financial reporting and budget books, and they really kind of don't get into things like grade distributions or student passing rates on different exams. And what this kind of does is it places the president in this very precarious position between what the controllers, the governing board, governance body wants, and what faculty really kind of have an interest in.
Rich?
Let me first make a remark about the previous topic of abortions and the like and free speech. I am so much in favor of women's rights and women's control of their own decision-making and their own bodies that it's hard for me to see the opposite case. But there is a case on the other side, and I'd like to think, you know, having to do with the rights to life. And I would like to hope that in an academic environment, the way this subject is debated and treated would be much better than the way it's being carried out in society these days. And as far as the issue about finances, it's true that finances are controlling the way things are going in many universities these days. And I think, unfortunately, that's necessary. And I don't have the same view as we just heard because many of the financial problems that are arising are caused by student choices. So, for example, we've seen at IU a migration of students away from the humanities into areas that are, let's say, more fruitful in terms of potential jobs and future prospects. And that's caused enormous stress to the university that requires some kind of change. It's not as if this is caused by the students and their choices, and the university is behind the eight ball. And I think that administrators are put under a lot of stress in trying to find a way to solve these problems. And it's not easy to see how to do it.
And I think a little bit about what Professor Miller was saying, and maybe what you're saying, is perhaps administrators deserve a little bit of grace for trying to thread the needle on this. Yeah. Russ?
I think it's an empirical question of which approach really is going to be most effective. You know, I think that issue of austerity budgets has been pretty much an issue since the 1980s and Ronald Reagan, and the government got into the business of making massive cuts. Unfortunately, those austerity budgets don't always fall equally. You know, in the 80s, it was social services, the social service net, that was cut. And I think I was, you know, when I came into the meeting on Tuesday as a retired professor, I haven't been that involved, obviously, in the day-to-day management issues as I was before. But I was surprised by the level of pushback and almost anger about some of the management practices of this administration in terms of kind of not really, you know, if I think austerity works if there's a shared belief in the need for that, if everyone can see that we are in terrible financial shape and those decisions are made collaboratively. But I think there was I heard a lot of testimony that departments were nearly being cut, that centers were having staff cut or directors cut without much explanation. And so I think it's kind of an empirical question. Does that method work? It's something that you guys as journalists could start asking, you know, which is are those cuts being made in the most effective and humane way possible?
Let me offer our contact information. You can call us at 812-855-0811 or toll free at 1-877-285-9348. You can also send questions to news@indianapublicmedia.org. You can also follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at WFIU, WTIU News, and send questions there. Aubrey?
Yeah. So what we've been talking about, to me, seems like it goes along with what the Board of Trustees have been saying and what Pamela Witten mentioned in her statement, which is that higher education is changing very rapidly and that there needs to be some kind of forward movement so universities can stay alive. But I was wondering your input as faculty, and maybe Megan, your reporting can inform you on this, but what is it like when it seems like your input isn't always included while these changes are being made so quickly?
Okay. I agree with what Russ said and with the idea that there has been too much top-down control of decision-making by our administrators. I understand why this has happened, because faculty as a whole are about as resistant to change as any other group in society. Faculty want everything to continue the way they've always been forever. So I understand why there's a tendency for administrators to want to make needed change by taking control and just doing it. On the other hand, that's arrogant. That is taking the view that there is no wisdom, expertise, and good judgment on the parts of the faculty, and there has to be a way to make both happen, to take the advice of the faculty and work out plans with them to make needed change while still allowing change to take place. And that hasn't been happening and should be.
Russ?
Yeah, I totally agree, and that perception, that feeling was really almost palpable among those that were speaking the other day, that their voices were just not being heard. But you know, these, you know, I want to get back to that notion of what is status quo. I think respect for faculty governance, for diversity and equity, for freedom of expression, those, I would hope that those things are seen as the status quo, and those things are under very serious attack by a radical minority in this country, and that radical minority is firmly ensconced as a supermajority in the Indiana General Assembly, and I think there's an understanding that we cannot rely on status quo. It's going to take some very serious resistance on the part of faculties and on the part of administrations to preserve the status quo, to preserve the values, as Rich said. I mean, not everything that everybody wants to keep the same ought to be kept the same, but there are some very fundamental values here of respect for faculty, freedom of expression, and respect for civil rights that I think all of us should be fighting pretty hard to protect.
I think, I mean, this whole concept of academic freedom seems to be, I mean, that's a phrase that we've heard over and over again on the Indiana University campus. Megan, is that under attack nationwide? Does this seem to be part of the fabric of these discussions and these no confidence votes, the idea that academic freedom among faculty members and on campuses with research are no longer being respected?
So typically with votes of no confidence, historically we haven't seen academic freedom called out per se as a reason for these, going back to, you know, the 80s. But I think in the last couple of years, that is a theme that we've seen more and more of. Certainly both of the themes that Russell and Rush and Richard mentioned of, you know, worries about top-down administration, about faculty not having input, of unease with the status quo. Those are all things that do feed into these votes as well. I think, you know, in terms of academic freedom, it's certainly a battle that presidents are having to wage more publicly than they've ever had to before, with more of a national spotlight. And so there's certainly more room for disagreement, and I think public disagreement, as you're seeing with these votes of no confidence.
Megan, what usually happens after a vote of no confidence? Is there any standard procedure, outcome?
That's a good question. So nothing automatically happens. Votes of no confidence don't have any sort of power in an authority in and of themselves. But we do have some data on this at the Chronicle, and this is partially based on data from Sean McInnes as well. But about 51% of the time, so just over half, a president on the receiving end of a vote of no confidence ends up leaving office within a year. And those leavings, those resignations, retirements, whatever they may be, are very often not directly or publicly linked to the vote of no confidence. But certainly I think you see, you know, when the faculty declares publicly that they're not sure how much they believe in their leader's ability to believe, there is a tension that arises. And so it's not maybe surprising that, you know, another Chronicle project that we have found in the last 5 years, 13% of presidential resignations were linked in some way to a no confidence vote. Of course, none of that is a guarantee, but we do see historically about half the time, again, presidents, and this is only about votes of no confidence against presidents, do end up leaving within the year.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Rich. I wanted to make a comment about the changing state of the universities in the U.S. because I think there's a really fundamental problem and issue going on. We in the United States have achieved enormous success in part because of the way that we've taken the best thinkers in the entire world into the United States, into our university system, because, among other things, they like the way we operate. We like the freedoms and the rules that we have operated with. And now politics have intruded into the system in various ways. Among the other things, we've seen, for example, the immigration laws and so on that are changing. we are now losing some of the many best minds across the world that used to migrate to us and stay here and make our country better. And I see this change in the way the universities operate with respect to the rest of the world as a big danger. We're losing something important for society by these changes that are going on that are being forced by, let's say, politics and other things.
Yeah, and I have a question for you guys as people who were present at the vote who shared, you know, your perspective. Megan mentioned that these votes usually don't result in people leaving office, but I was wondering at IU, is that what you guys were hoping would happen? Like, what is the ideal outcome for this vote?
Russ?
I don't remember hearing. Now, I don't know what was in, in the minds of all of the organizers or those who voted. I don't remember hearing any specific hope that President Whitten would sit down, would step down. I do think it was meant in large part to send a message of just a very high degree of discomfort is probably too mild a word, disapproval and dissent for these policies, and a strong message that the faculty feels it hasn't been listened to, and a strong message, I think, that that there has not been enough attention paid to issues of freedom of expression and to issues of protecting the university from the incursions that, and I want to be clear here that we are not a very diverse group on this show. I'm pleased we have one woman here. Mm-hmm. But it's important, and that happens all too often, that we neglect to talk about those who will be most deeply impacted by it. And these attacks on diversity, equity, and inclusion, when all of the DEI staff of the University of Florida and the DEI staff in Texas were unceremoniously fired, that was a very large majority of faculty and staff of color. And so I think we have to be aware of that. And if we value our the diversity, we value our colleagues of color and our LGBTQ faculty, we really need to stand up for them. We need to make that a priority as we move forward.
Let me say I am delighted with the panelists that we have. I do want to say Benta Boutier, our producer, reached out to a whole lot of different people who couldn't come for a variety of reasons.
So, I'm not making any charges. I know you were trying.
I know. But we're delighted to have all three of you here with us. I just want to ask, when Megan says, 51% of presidents that are faced with a no confidence vote are gone within a year, that's a very real potential outcome. I just want to ask the two of you and let me ask Megan first. Has there been any kind of research that you know of about who replaces these people? Because if we're in a situation now where, this political situation that we're talking about, the people who selected Pam Whitten would be essentially the same people who are going to select the person that replaces her. So – what happens when people get a no confidence vote and leave? What happens to leadership after that? Megan, do you have any sense of that?
I should say first that some no confidence votes do actually explicitly call for a president's resignation. That will be in the body of the text of the vote itself. As you said, that was not the case here. To your question, though, about what happens afterward, I think you're right that, there's no solid data on specifically no confidence votes and what happens with the replacement of a president afterward. But certainly overall, in terms of who might, replace a president, we're seeing the duration of a college presidency in the United States get shorter and shorter. Mm-hmm. I think the most recent data on that is something in the neighborhood of 5 years, whereas, historically we might have seen a president running a ship for even 20 years or more. And so that's, unusual, the amount of turnover. I think a lot of faculty members will say we feel like presidents and senior administrators are increasingly coming from the professional and the business worlds rather than perhaps through the faculty ranks. That's a concern that I've heard as well. I couldn't speak, obviously, to the specific selection process at IU if it were to happen, but those mechanisms are largely the same.
Mm-hmm. Richard?
Yeah, when a sports team doesn't do well, they fire the coach. Usually it's because the players aren't doing very well, and they change the coach, and then the new coach doesn't do any better. That is very typical. When we get rid of presidents because of no confidence and sometimes because they make mistakes, we get new presidents, and it's not usually the case that we do better necessarily. I mentioned in my remarks the other day that distinguished professors went to the trustees and asked that John Ryan be fired. They did. I don't know if that was the reason, but they did. He moved on to a great career at SUNY, and the same professors that said he ought to be fired gave him an award a number of years later for his wonderful service both at SUNY and at IU, because in comparison to the other presidents, he began to look rather good.
Russ, did you have a comment you want to make about that?
Yeah, it's just really hard to say what's going to happen. I just don't have a crystal ball on it. This is unprecedented. You know, it's unprecedented both in terms of the level of conflict between the faculty and the administration, but also the attacks that the university is under. Bob Arnov, who many of us regard as kind of the grand, well, I won't call him, he wouldn't like it if I called him the grand old man, but the a leading light for his length of time here, and a leading activist for all of his time. He said in his 50 years that he's been involved, he's never seen the kind of threats that there are against with faculty right now. He's never seen that, and has said it's really important for universities to stand up to that.
Mm-hmm. And I do have a question for Richard. It was submitted, and it is, what would it take for you to give up on the administration, on the coach instead of the players, after 3 years of service?
I think give up is the wrong word. If you're asking for, personal opinion, it'll go up and down depending on the decisions that are made and how the university is doing. Mm-hmm. If the university is going downhill, and doesn't change for the better, then I would personally be in favor of a change, of course. But I don't really, like most faculty, as opposed to Russ, for example, I am not very conversant with what the high-level administrators actually do day to day. There's a lot of things they do. I mean, I assume that a president spends half their time fundraising, for example, which we don't talk about, things like that. So I don't really know what higher-level administrators do, but I see the state of the university, and I would be in favor of change if the university was going in the wrong direction enough that it bothered me enough. And whether we would see a change for the better, who knows? I would hope so, but one never knows.
I think just to go back to the issue of status quo, I'm going to look at that in a little bit different way. A lot of times, Rich mentioned when they change the coach, the new coach will come in and talk about, we're going to do things a lot better than you did it before. It seems to me that there may be some of that going on with President Whitten, that when she came in, a lot of things changed. A lot of people changed. A lot of people who had been involved deeply with the university were no longer in their positions. How much do you think that has to do with the no confidence in her, that perhaps there wasn't the recognition of the history of Indiana University and the good that Indiana University had done prior to the new administration coming on?
That's a really good question, and I think there's some truth to that. I think, there's a perception, I think, among faculty here at Indiana University and throughout the country, really, that faculty governance has been eroding over the last 20 or 30 years. But I think faculty here are very independent and very committed to faculty governance. And yeah, I'd tell you, if I were to sit down with President Whitten right now, I'd say, you know, you just got to get along. You got to find a way. You know, there all of these incidents are incidents of conflict with the faculty, and I would think that would be a huge priority for her right now, to find ways to work with the faculty and communicate with the faculty to move the university forward.
Megan, what do you think we can expect next here at Indiana University when it comes to trying to navigate through this issue? I know you've got some data. Have you seen anything, you know, in the stories that you've done and the stories that the Chronicle has done that might suggest a path forward?
You know, it's difficult to say. As you say, it's about a 50-50 chance of, you know, whether or not a president would end up leaving office. I think in the immediate short term, though, it's a very crucial period for IU, for administrators, for faculty. I'm sure the imperative is there very much on all sides for folks to want to work together, to want to – clearly there's an appetite for change of some sort. And, you know, the president probably would do well to maybe, you know, listen to faculty about what those changes might be. If there is a, you know, a need for that, then that might be something that she avails herself of. She does, as we've talked about, have the full support of the Board of Trustees. That's something that you don't always see after a vote of no confidence, so it's a pretty strong sign that, you know, the folks that ultimately hire and fire presidents do have strength and faith in her abilities. So that's a positive sign, certainly, going forward.
We have about just 2 minutes to go, and I want to ask this last question. We didn't have the pro. I didn't read anything from the provost statement, but a lot of what he talked about was the need for people to work together. He did. It was a very sort of conciliatory comment, it seemed to me, talking about how he wanted to listen, and he wanted to listen to what people were upset about and try to forge a path forward. How confident are both of you in the idea that the university can have now shared governance involving the faculty and the administration and move forward as a very strong institution?
Well, it certainly is possible. We'll see if it happens. If the changes in the way that things are currently operating take place, that'll be for the good. But we won't know until it happens.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. I'm kind of an empiricist on these things. You know, you can't just say we need to work together. The proof is in the pudding, clearly. But, you know, I think there's an opportunity to test that almost immediately on both sides, the administration and the faculty. And that has to do with the implementation of 202. As I said, that report is due on September 1st. Anyone who says it's the legislature is going to expect a skimming over kind of report is deluding themselves. They're going to want a very detailed report. I think it's incumbent upon the faculty. The Bloomington Faculty Council meeting was canceled due to this vote. I think it's incumbent upon the leaders of the Bloomington Faculty Council to have one more meeting to say to the administration and the board, we need to be involved in the implementation of 202. And we need to see protection for our faculty of color and LGBTQ faculty. And I think the administration could show that they're working with the faculty in the same way by saying, yes, we are going to have faculty involvement and we're going to protect faculty of color.
Okay, so. We are out of time, Russ. Thank you. I want to thank our guest Megan Zanies from the Chronicle of Higher Education and our two faculty members, Russ Skiba and Richard Schifrin, for being here with us today to talk about these issues. And also, Aubrey Wright, thank you for joining me as co-host. And our engineer, Mike Pashkash, and producer, Bente Boutier. I'm Bob Zaltzberg. Thanks for listening.
Production support for Noon Edition comes from Smithville, fiber internet, security solutions, and voice in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Bloomington Health Foundation, empowering a community and government partners by bringing together nonprofits, businesses, and philanthropists on initiatives to gain access to healthcare resources. Learn more at bloomhf.org. and from Estate and Downsizing Specialists, LLC, offering complete turnkey service for estate and downsizing clients, from initial consultation through home cleanout to final real estate and personal property sales. More at edsindiana.com.